Gospel Tangents needs your support. Please consider donating to our website, gospeltangents.com. We'll use your donation to help produce other podcasts and professional documentaries such as this. Welcome to Gospel Tangents Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Bennett. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion so far with Dr. Paul Reeve of the University of Utah. This was our last conversation with Paul, and it's time to ask his opinions on how to apply these lessons of the past to today's situations. It's one of my favorite parts of the interview. I asked Paul how he felt about the Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing at President Trump's inauguration. I also asked if there were any parallels between the black man and the new gay ban, and asked if he had anything to do with writing the Gospel Topics essay titled Race and the Priesthood on LDS.org. He was very candid, and I think you'll enjoy listening to his answers on these and other topics. Let's listen into our conversation. Let's move on. I've already taken way more time than I said I was going to, but just want to kind of finish up, bring us a little bit more to modern day. I believe it was 2012-2013 the LDS Church came out with a new race essay. Some think that it went too far in blaming Brigham Young for the ban. Some people think it didn't go far enough, that it didn't apologize for the ban or state explicitly. It kind of hints at, well, there were a lot of other explanations, but just ignore them. They weren't correct. But mm-hmm. They don't talk about what they were, the curse of Cain, curse of Ham. So where do you kind of fit on that? And what do you think?
Yeah, I think that it's probably, well, I guess for me, the LDS Church does not issue a major disavowal that frequently. So it disavows previous teachings. That doesn't happen very often. So in my estimation, it's a pretty big step. And it also includes the condemnation of all racism, past and present, and that includes within Mormonism. So there's a condemnation of racism and a major disavowal of black skin being a curse, of interracial marriage as a sin, of blacks or any other ethnic or racial group as being inferior in any sort of way whatsoever to anyone else. And so in my estimation, those are really important steps forward, and actually a major step forward. It was approved by the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve. Certainly, some people would want more. It stops short of arguing one way or the other as to if the racial restriction was of divine origins or of human origins, but certainly gives the impression that it grew out of simply a racial culture, not out of divine origins. And so, all those things considered, I think it was a pretty dramatic step.
I believe it was in the 1980s. 81, if I remember right, Ronald Esplin, he's a church historian, came out with an essay kind of refuting Lester Bush's 1973 essay, in which Lester tried to pin the beginnings of the ban about 1847, and it seems to be when Parley P. Pratt was speaking against Warner McCary. So Esplin tried to push it back to possibly some secret temple teachings. It seems, as I recall, there were some people that still want to try to pin the ban back on Joseph Smith. Number one, are you familiar with that? And have you talked to Ron Esplin to see how he feels about that?
I have not personally talked to Ron. I am familiar with his article. I just don't buy the argument in the article. Seems to suggest that Brigham Young didn't do anything that Joseph Smith didn't first do. And you simply have to have evidence, and at least to date, there is no existing evidence of Joseph Smith articulating a race-based priesthood restriction or a race-based temple restriction. And in fact, the evidence suggests otherwise. Elijah Abel actually says that Joseph Smith sanctions his priesthood. He was ordained an elder. We don't know who ordained him an elder in March of 1836, but there is a certificate that survives with Joseph Smith's signature on it, which defines Elijah Abel as an ordained minister, ordained and able to preach the Mormon gospel, articulates his priesthood as an elder. It's not his ordination certificate, but it is a certificate signed by Joseph Smith where Joseph Smith's signature is saying that, yes, this Elijah Abel is a minister representing Mormonism. Right.
And would that be similar to have a missionary card today that missionaries carry out?
Yes.
Or ordained minister?
Exactly right. That's okay. Exactly right. Elijah Abel, when he's interviewed by Joseph F. Smith in 1879, says, "Joseph Smith sanctioned my priesthood." The evidence is contrary to any suggestion that Joseph Smith began the priesthood restriction. So we have no statements by Joseph Smith articulating a race-based priesthood restriction. So, you know, you just have to, historians have to follow the evidence, and I just don't see the evidence. I mean, you can't sort of just simply surmise, in my estimation, that Brigham Young never did anything that Joseph Smith didn't at least initiate at first. And the other point that's really important for me, at least, in putting the pieces together is that Brigham Young is on record in 1847 as favorably aware of Q. Walker Lewis's priesthood. And then in his speech on the 5th of February, 1852, he says, "If no other prophet ever said it before me, I say it now," where he's also seems to be striking out on his own. And so all of those together, in my estimation, put the priesthood restriction at the feet of Brigham Young as beginning it. Right. We don't have evidence that Joseph Smith did, but we do have evidence where Brigham Young is forcefully stating that he is the first prophet who's stating it.
Very good. Now, I want to ask you another question. I'm hoping you'll answer. I've heard rumors, and that's all they are is rumors, that you had played a role in compiling that essay. Do you have any response to that?
I did help with the essay.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Yes. So was that... Can you describe your role?
Well, the Church History Department invited me to write an extended essay. It ended up being about 55 pages long, with footnotes and everything like I would produce as an academic essay. And once they were satisfied with that, it was sent up the line, several layers of kind of an approval process, and then the Church History Department actually boiled down that longer essay to what got posted online. So I had no say over what got posted online, what eventually appeared as Race and the Priesthood, but it was a condensed version of the longer piece that I produced for them.
Very much condensed. If it was 55 pages, yeah. Now it's, what, 3-4 pages? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it prints out at with the footnotes at like 8 pages at LDS.org. But very much condensed. But the fuller essay was sent up the line, and then it was out of my hands after that, and they condensed it down to what was published at LDS.org. Yeah.
Well, that's cool. That's very cool. I'll have to get a copy of that 55 pages.
They have that in their control. But actually, you know, the 55 pages are basically a boiled down version of the 4 chapters in the book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the Church History Department was aware that I was doing research on this topic and invited me to participate. It's the 55 pages, like I said, are basically a condensed version of the 4 chapters. And I got to say whatever I wanted in the 4 chapters in the book because it's published by Oxford, and there are obviously no restrictions there. So if you want sort of the full version, you can look at those 4 chapters in the book.
All right. Well, I have to tell you, I highly recommend that book. That's an awesome, awesome book. So
thank you.
Well done. Do you think the church will ever apologize for the ban?
I doubt it. I'm kind of skeptical that they will. But, you know, it's hard to predict the future and what the next generation of leadership might look like and how attitudes may change over time. But I don't see this generation of leaders apologizing. The statement doesn't apologize, right? But it does disavow and it does condemn. And I think that's probably as far as they were willing to go at this point.
Cool. I know some historians have likened the ban on blacks to the current ban on gays within the church. Do you see these as similar, or is there a significant difference?
Well, I guess there are ways in which you could see them as similar and ways in which I think they're distinct. So the similarities could be that, you know, is this simply sort of the cultural context, right, that is somehow seeping in, and it would be hard to argue that the cultural context of, you know, America moving towards legalizing gay marriage didn't impact Mormonism, right? And so it's Mormonism responding to its cultural context, the same way that Mormonism seemed to respond to the racial context in the 19th century. So parallels there, but I think also important distinctions. So for race and priesthood in particular, there is an historical precedent, right? So black men were ordained to the priesthood in the early decades of Mormonism. And I'm not aware of a precedent for gay marriage in the early decades of Mormonism. And then the other important distinction is that black people in Mormonism were the only group prevented from having all of the saving rituals that Mormonism requires for the Mormon heaven. You can be gay and receive all the saving ordinances that Mormonism requires. And so black people are the only group that I'm aware of that were ever prevented from actually receiving all the saving ordinances. So it's not the same kind of pressure point. Now, I realize that gay Latter-day Saints like gay marriage as, you know, a part of that process. But nonetheless, they're not barred from receiving the endowments. They're not barred from, you know, temple participation like black people were. Black people were prevented from receiving all the saving ordinances. And the same thing for female priesthood ordination, right? You make the same kind of case that it's not necessary for saving ordinances, and so it's not the same kind of issue as it was with black Latter-day Saints, who were only allowed to be baptized and receive the gift of the Holy Ghost, but prevented from receiving the other saving ordinances that Mormonism defines as necessary for exaltation. So that's the only case I'm aware of that that comes into impact. Now, if we talk about the more recent marriage policy, we're talking about children of gay couples who are being prevented from those saving ordinances. So there may be a new parallel there, right? Being prevented from having the saving ordinances, not of your own volition, but simply because your parents are in a gay marriage. And so that's the first time that I see us returning back, or Mormonism returning back to something that had, where they had prevented a group, in this case, black Latter-day Saints, from receiving all the saving ordinances, and now they're preventing, and not because of their own sins, right? Not because of worthiness, but because of Cain killing Abel. And in this case, once again, gay parents, children of gay parents, not because of their own choices, but because of their parents' choices. So that is a parallel that I see that wasn't in existence before the most recent policy came into play.
Well, so that brings up another point. I know immediately after the announcement, the November 2015 announcement, I believe it was, where they prevented children of gay parents from being ordained or baptism or whatever. I know a lot of people came out with the Second Article of Faith, as Orson Pratt did in the legislature. Men should be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression. I'll tell you what, I've had some debates online about whether, you know, does God punish, as Orson Pratt said, only this generation, or does he punish future or future generations through not allowing ordinances? So, you know, some people say, well, God's cursed lots of people You know, you can read the Bible. There's lots of curses in the Bible that are supposedly from God, or, you know, the prophets claim are from God.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you interpret it? I guess I'm putting your theologian hat on there.
Yeah.
But how do you feel about that? You know, especially with the regards to the second article of faith.
Sure. So my understanding of curse is not something that God distributes, but in fact that a person may curse themselves. Curse is a separation from God, and it's through the person's actions, and that can be overcome simply through repentance. So I see that as how curses are supposed to operate, right? That's not how Brigham Young articulated it, and Arson Pratt, as you note, pushes back against it. And I see it as a violation of the second article of faith. Absolutely. I see the position that Brigham Young staked out in 1852 as a violation of the second article of faith. He's holding all black people accountable for Cain's murder of Abel, something they did not participate in. That's a violation of the principle Joseph Smith establishes in the second article of faith. And I see then the November 5th policy also as a violation of that second article of faith, holding children of gay couples accountable for decisions they are not making themselves. Yeah. So, you know, I absolutely do see it as a violation of the second article of faith.
Great. One other parallel I just wanted to point out, you know, you mentioned the one drop rule, that there were probably lots of people with more than one drop of blood who were ordained, but they looked white. With the gays, there have been lots of gays ordained, not openly. Maybe they got married in the temple or whatever, got the priesthood as they should have done at certain ages, but then, you know, came out as gay after and now have the priesthood. So it's kind of interesting to me that you know, it seems like we're reverting back to the days of Brigham Young. We're trying to prevent this, but it's an impossible thing to prevent. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, a person even can be openly gay and hold the priesthood and be ordained to the priesthood, as long as they're adhering to what the church articulates as its law of chastity. Right. So you can openly identify as gay and still be ordained to the priesthood. And so that's a way in which, you know, it's a distinction or a difference from how the racial priesthood restriction operated. But you're right. I mean, in terms of a person's sexual identity and if they're open about it or not open about it and being ordained to the priesthood to happening regardless of whether they're open or not open about it. So it is, you know, like the one drop rule was impossible to police. Trying to police someone's sexual identity is probably also very problematic as well.
Okay, well, I'm just going to ask you one last question and I'll let you go. So, you know, the Tabernacle Choir is going to be singing here at the inauguration of soon-to-be President Trump. A lot of people, I would expect Orson Pratt probably wouldn't think that would be a good idea. You know, what are your thoughts about, you know, President Trump has been very vocal about race and not in a way that I don't think Mormons are comfortable with. He got the lowest vote total of any Republican in Utah in decades, probably since Roosevelt, I believe, or maybe Johnson. But what are your thoughts about, you know, the church sending the choir to President Trump's inauguration?
You're hitting all the hot button issues. You're not letting me off easy here. I would prefer that the Tabernacle Choir don't go. I just think as much distance from Donald Trump as possible is a good thing. Even if we were to talk about simple religious pluralism and religious freedom, it's a position that the church has staked out for itself. It is always strongly advocated for religious liberty, religious freedom. And we have a president who is arguing for a Muslim ban on immigration and also suggested Muslim surveillance, a Muslim registry, those type of things that are just absolutely shine in the face of religious liberty. And if that was the only principle that they wanted to stand on. I would love for them to stand on that principle. When Trump first articulated his position on a Muslim ban, the LDS newsroom did issue a statement where they cited Joseph Smith's position in Nauvoo welcoming Muslims. And so they did speak out then, but the fact that the choir is going just seems like, you know, too close an association with a president who has staked out positions on race, on religious liberty, and his actual attitudes towards women. Those kind of things just really kind of shine in the face of fundamental Mormon principles. So it's just a personal opinion. I would rather they not go. Just stay as far away from Mormonism teaches, right? Its adherence, right? Stay away from the edge. don't muddy the water. You know, don't flirt with evil, those kind of things. And so, you know, for me, that's a principle that's at play here. I know other people have articulated other Mormon principles that they believe is at play and actually suggest that that's a reason for the Mormon Tabernacle Choir to perform. To me, it doesn't outweigh the reasons not to perform. So my personal position is I wish they weren't going, but I don't get to make those decisions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. Like I said, I know it took way longer than I told you I would. So it's been a pleasure. I hope that you're open to another interview, maybe a Mountain Meadows Massacre or some, you know, benign topic like that.
Yeah. Yes, we can cover all the other hot button issues.
All right. Well, once again, thank you, Paul Reeve. Really appreciate your time here on Mormon Tangents.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate Paul for taking time to talk with us, and I hope you'll learn as much as I did. Black History Month is almost over, so we'll end the month talking about the first documented former slave to join the church. He's known in Mormon journals as Black Pete, and Dr. Mark Staker of the Church History Library tells us about his conversion to the Church of Christ in November 1830, about 6 months after the church was organized in New York. Black Pete lived in Kirtland, Ohio.
Mormon missionaries baptized most of the members of the Morty family. And Black Pete participates in all this. He's preaching and helping with baptisms later on. So we have to assume that he's baptized and that he's ordained a priest as well.
I hope you'll tune in to our next conversation with Dr. Staker. For more information, please subscribe to our website, gospeltangents.com. where you can purchase a transcript of this podcast for just $3. You can also get one on Amazon.com. Please subscribe to iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube to get updated interviews. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you'll continue to support us here at GospelTangents.com.